Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's lecture. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm director of the European Institute here at the London School of Economics. It's my very great pleasure to welcome you to this, the fifth lecture in our series of lectures on Europe this term. I must, of course, begin with an apology for the delayed start, and thank you for your understanding. The reason for the delay is that we have just been attending a press conference here at the LSE to announce the launch of a new permanent chair, a professorship, here at the LSE in contemporary Turkish studies. This, as you can imagine, is a major development for the school and specifically for our European Institute. Indeed, our speaker this evening represents one of the supporters of the new chair, and we are very grateful to the Central Bank for their support. I'll try to be brief. You've been patient waiting for the lecture to start. The title of tonight's lecture is The Turkish Economy and the European Union. Mr. Sorye Sedenceci, I apologize for my pronunciation. I might try that again later before I finish. Mr. Sedenceci is governor of the Central Bank of Turkey. He's had a long career at the bank, having first started there in 1980. He served in a range of capacities at the bank, providing him with very broad professional experience. He holds degrees in economics from the Middle Eastern Technical University and from Vanderbilt in the United States. He became governor of the Central Bank in March 2001. As governor, he has gained a widespread respect for his approach to economic and monetary policy. I know that he is warmly respected by his peers. The Turkish economy has shown signs of clear strength in recent years, following the difficulties that led to the major loan from the International Monetary Fund. The agreement with the IMF entails a tight fiscal policy, the restructuring of state banks, extensive privatization, and a series of reforms to improve the environment for business. With the new policy discipline, the Turkish economy has shown definite improvements. Official data show that the annual growth rate, gross domestic product, in the last 3 years has been set between 6% and 10%. Moreover, the official forecast for the next 3 years for annual growth is set, I believe, at 5%. Of course, major challenges remain. Not least of these is managing the exchange rate of the Turkish lira and the reforms of the banking sector and the process of privatization also pose their own difficulties, I'm sure. With the opening of the negotiations with the European Union, it is, of course, very timely for us to review the position of the Turkish economy. A year ago, we had the pleasure of hosting a lecture by Mr. Ali Babacan, Minister of Economics, a lecture given here at the LSE. Tonight, we are truly privileged to receive a lecture by another key actor in the transition of the Turkish economy. You've been patient. I will finish my introduction there. But I'll ask you to give a very warm welcome to our speaker this evening, the Governor of the Central Bank of Turkey, Mr. Sorye Sedenceci. Thank you.
First of all, I want to thank Professor Featherstone for the very nice introduction, which once again confirmed that I was born and raised at the Central Bank. Distinguished academicians, guests, of course, it's a great pleasure for me to be here with you today at the LSE and to have an opportunity to give the lecture on such a delicate subject that is the Turkish economy in the context of the European Union. I would also like to express my heartfelt thanks for the establishment of the chair in contemporary Turkish studies that I believe will play an important role in the relations between Turkey and the European Union. I want to begin my speech by first giving you a simple description of Turkey on its way towards the European Union membership. I will be referring to the words of Sir Winston Churchill. On November 10, 1942, after the victory at El Alamein that changed the course of the Second World War, he said, "This is not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end. But it is perhaps the end of the beginning." Personally, I think this is exactly how we should see the Turkish membership in the European Union as of October the 3rd. It is simply the end of a long beginning. Three important points now. The first one is about the fact that in Turkey, the EU accession has always been a long-term goal. In historical perspective, as you all know very well, the EU is a sui generis structure implying a legal, political, and economic project of integration shaped around contemporary values. Quoting Prime Minister Tony Blair's own words this time, "This is a union of values, of solidarity between nations and people, of not just a common market in which we trade, but a common political space in which we live as citizens." On the other side, as Atatürk, the founder of the modern Turkish Republic, clearly stated, the contemporary level of civilization has always been Turkey's main objective since its foundation as a republic out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire. Therefore, considering the main principles of the European Union and Turkey's desires to reach the contemporary level of civilization, Turkey's everlasting willingness to be a member of the European Union shouldn't be surprising. Accordingly, Turkey, in fact, had applied to the European Union for full membership back in 1959. During these 46 years, governments with different political views have been in charge. Despite some delays, setbacks, and obstacles in relations with the Union all over this period, our aim of full membership has never changed. Also, the majority of the Turkish society has always been supporting the main goal of full membership. In fact, 68% of the public who answered the most recent questionnaire of Eurobarometer in 2005 responded in favor of full membership. The second point out of these three that I want to make now is about the whole process leading to the eventual membership of Turkey to the European Union. The eventual membership will depend on a lot of factors, political and economic. Clearly, it's hard to know in advance what the outcome of the process will be. But what I believe is that whatever the outcome, the whole process until the final stage is more important than the outcome itself. And that's because the process will involve serious political, legal, and economic reforms that we have to do for ourselves in Turkey anyway. The third point now is that there is a deterministic issue, and that is globalization. As Alan Greenspan indicated in one of his speeches, globalization has altered the economic frameworks of both advanced and developing nations in ways that are difficult to fully comprehend. In other words, it is obvious that we cannot complete our analysis related to the European Union and Turkey by disregarding globalization and its effects on the functioning of the world economy and individual countries. In recent decades, increasing number of countries have been integrating to the world economy and politics, so the world is going through a rapid alteration. Hence, this change brings about new challenges to the international arena that even industrialized countries have difficulties to cope with. I believe that the notion of enlargement provides a means for the European Union to increase its power both in political and economic environment in the world and to face challenges in the international arena as a global power. I will refer once again to Prime Minister Tony Blair's words. "It will be a Europe confident enough to see enlargement not as a threat, as if membership were a zero-sum game in which old members lose as new members gain, but an extraordinary historic opportunity to build a greater and more powerful union. Because be under no illusion, if we stop enlargement or shut out its natural consequences, it will in the end save one job, keep one firm in business, prevent one delocalization. For a time it might, but not for long. And in the meantime, Europe will become more narrow, more introspective, and those who garner support will be those no in the traditions of European idealism, but in those of outdated nationalism and xenophobia. But I tell you in all frankness," he said, It's a contradiction to be in favor of liberalizing Europe's membership, but against opening up its economy. Since its foundation back in 1957, the European Union has continuously been engaged in a process of enlargement. The process, having begun with the inclusion of the United Kingdom, Ireland, and Denmark in 1973 after the original six members, has proceeded for the time being with the challenging accession of the 10 Central and Eastern European countries on May 1st, 2004. Thus, enlargement has become an important aspect of the European Union policy. Distinguished guests, almost in every meeting on the European Union and the Turkish economy, I'm faced with questions such as, what can Turkey contribute to the European Union? In other words, what will be the advantages of the European Union from Turkey's membership? Or, what does Turkey expect from being a full member of the Union? All the time, all the questions come down to these two basic questions. But in fact, there are no easy and quick answers to these questions. Therefore, my answer will rather be a long one. Apparently, there are very strong arguments in favor of Turkish membership such that Turkey will bring the Islamic world and the Western world together, or a larger EU with Turkey will certainly be a much bigger power playing an important role in the world. Apart from political aspects, it is clear that the debate on the Turkish membership is very much related to the economic structure of Turkey. Hence, I want to make one thing clear. Although membership is a political decision in essence, my answers to the questions that I just mentioned will focus more mainly on economic aspects. Having this in mind, now I'd like to start with the notion of competitiveness on a global level and its implications for both Turkey and the European Union. The 20th century has been a new era in terms of diminishing borders in trade and means of production and led to increasing competition all around the world. As we all know, Europe and the United States had been the engines of world development in the last few centuries. However, emergence of new actors into the picture in recent decades has changed the global economic environment. Despite the fact that the role of the United States has been continuing with an increasing weight, that of the European Union has been rather slow. And hence today, together with the United States, new global actors are coming to the forefront, for example, emerging from Asia, such as India and China. To be more precise, between the years 1980 and 2004, so it's a total of 24 years, the share of the European Union, the 12 countries, trade in total world trade decreased by 8%, while that of East Asia and Pacific region countries increased by 165%. During the same period, the United States also increased its share in total world trade by 13%. We observe a similar pattern in terms of growth as well. In fact, the largest rise in shares in total world output since 1980 belonged to East Asia and Pacific region countries by 68%. However, the share of the EU-12's output in total world output decreased by 10% during the same period. It is exactly at this point that Turkey comes into the picture of the European Union as one of the new actors in the global economy. So I will elaborate briefly now on the achievements in Turkey in the last 4 years. Since the 2001 crisis, a comprehensive stabilization program has been put with determination into practice. Tight monetary and fiscal policies, along with an intensive structural reform agenda, have been the three main pillars of the program. Thanks to these policies, firstly, disinflation has finally succeeded. Inflation targets have been reached in three consecutive years. The inflation rate of 73% in January 2002 is now down to single digits, that is 8% as of September 2005, and that comes after three decades of high and chronic inflation. Furthermore, not only inflation fell to single digits, but also dynamics of inflation have changed significantly, and that, of course, ensures the irreversibility of the disinflation process in Turkey. After so many failures in three decades, the turning point, in fact, came when the Central Bank of Turkey has been granted independence, and that came after 30 years of hesitation. In May 2001, the central bank law was amended so that the primary objective of the central bank has been defined as to achieve and maintain price stability. And since November 2001, no credits are extended to the public sector. Very simple. I should say that these developments have been the milestones of disinflation in Turkey. Inflation has been coming down in Turkey exactly since November 2001. So the remedy was so simple. The change in inflationary dynamics also came as a result of a very transparent communication policy, which has been instrumental in changing the expectations of the public about stabilization. That was the biggest challenge back in 2001. Policies gained credibility, inflation inertia has decreased sharply, the volatility of inflation has too declined. Hence, the inflation target is now a more credible nominal anchor for economic agents, and I think that is very important. To sum it up today, Turkey appears to be catching up with the Maastricht criterion on inflation. Secondly, in recent years, the Turkish economy grew by a total of 28% in real terms between the end of 2001 and the first half of 2005. So it's 3.5 years. This is the highest rate among the European Union countries and the acceding countries such as Bulgaria and Romania, also one of the highest in the world. A closer look into the spectacular growth reveals the fact that these dynamics of growth have been changing as well. These high growth rates have been attained while inflation was coming down continuously, contrary to the widespread belief in Turkey up to 2002 that inflation in the past made growth possible. Such a great illusion. During this new era, the productivity surge in the economy and the private sector have been the engines of the growth performance. Actually, in the last 3 years, the cumulative increase in labor productivity is about 35%. Besides, it is essential to note that exports of goods are contributing to growth with an increasing share. And as a matter of fact, the total foreign trade volume in Turkey has gone up by 120% since 2001. The figure is the highest among acceding countries and all members. Turkey is now focusing on maintaining high growth rates on a sustainable path. The third point in developments in the Turkish economy is that tight fiscal policy and sound debt management brought substantial improvement to the debt dynamics, which was in the center of concerns together with inflation 4 years ago. So the gross public debt declined from 107% in 2001 to 74% by the second quarter of 2005. The Maastricht criterion on gross public debt may be met in the near future. These achievements on the macroeconomic front, the improvement in the debt dynamics, and the positive outlook for growth have brought more resilience to shocks and contributed to financial stability. Volatility in the financial markets has decreased, maturities are now longer, derivatives markets finally begin to develop. Though it is essentially a political decision, the negotiations between the European Union and Turkey would not have started at all if we had not made all these achievements in the economic arena. Distinguished participants, Turkey's membership implies an expansion of the European Union market. The Turkish economy is among the biggest 20 economies in the world. Turkey is a member of this G20 club. It is the largest economy in Eastern Europe, the Balkans, and the Middle East, second in the Black Sea basin, and the sixth among emerging market economies. Unlike most of the new member states at the start of negotiations, Turkey already has a functioning market economy, which is far advanced in meeting the economic chapters of the acquis communautaire. This is because of the start of the development of the market economy goes back to 1950, more or less. Relationship with the European Union goes back to 1963. And the completion of the customs union back to 1995. Indeed, Turkey is the only country that completed customs union without being a member. In a sense, Turkey is more integrated to the European markets than many new members and other candidates. When you look at the current account, Turkey has the second largest share after Poland in total trade volume towards the EU 15. And as of August 2005, the share of the EU25 in Turkey's total exports and imports are 52% and 42% respectively. Furthermore, 52% of the total number of foreign tourists visiting Turkey so far in 2005 are EU citizens. Viewing Turkey's capital accounts, it is noticeable that in the last 2 years, 85% of total foreign direct investment inflows to Turkey came from the European Union. That figure was 71% on average in the last 15 years. In consequence, the Turkish membership to the European Union will nourish this close economic relationship, I believe, further. Turkey's membership will not only create a market for the European Union in favor of both consumers and firms, but also help the European Union to become closer geographically to the Middle East, Russia, Black Sea, and Central Asia markets, and so increase its competitiveness. As you all know, Turkey is an important regional power at the crossroads of important, again, energy, transportation, and communication networks. It can also be said that Turkey is the only country in the region with the necessary institutional structure and capacity for integrating the region to the world economy through business association networks and partnerships. In addition to this, in terms of the EU's long-term energy policy, including petrol, natural gas, and water sources, the increasing importance of the Middle East and Caspian region has made Turkey a bridge to the energy sources in the region. With this strategic location, it is in the geostrategic interest of the European Union to have Turkey as a member with regard to the foreign and security policies dimensions. And I believe that the Turkish accession will be a strategic opportunity for Europe. Distinguished guests, despite the improvements in the Turkish economy, it is obvious that at the present stage, Turkey has lower income per capita compared to the new members and acceding countries. However, we know that income per capita of the new members and acceding countries, when they started negotiations, was similar to that of Turkey today. Actually, decomposing the equation of income per capita, we see that it's a product of productivity, employment rate, inverse of the dependency ratio and participation rate. In other words, increasing income per capita can be accelerated by productivity growth, increase in employment and labor participation rate, and decelerated by increase in the dependency ratio. I will use this basic equation as a tool to highlight the areas to be improved in Turkey and Turkey's possible contribution to the European Union in terms of productivity, demographic developments, and the repercussions of all these in the labor market. First of all, as Ben Bernanke, the new chairman of the Fed, indicated on one occasion, productivity growth is the principal source of improvements in living standards. And then we observed that during the last decade, the EU has lagged behind in productivity growth compared with other industrialized economies. In particular, labor productivity growth has been weak since the mid-1990s. Thus, while growth in hourly productivity in the 1980s stood at 2.4% on average in the euro area and at 1.3% in the United States, that trend has been reversed between 1996 and 2004, with an annual average in the euro area and in the United States of 1.3% and of 2.5% respectively. In the United States, productivity growth has even picked up to 4% per annum since 2001, despite adverse factors such as September 11 terrorist attacks, the 2001 recession, and the recent rise in energy prices. Of course, there are several reasons of the EU's lagging behind in the productivity growth. However, they are beyond the scope of my speech today. When the productivity comparison is made between Turkey and the new EU member states, it is seen that the average gross value added per employee was 10.9% in Turkey for the year 2004, while the same figure was 4.1 for Bulgaria, 4.2 for Romania, 10.9 for Poland, 11.5 for Hungary, and 11.7 for the Czech Republic. Turkey is not lagging behind these countries. It also has to be taken into consideration that some of these countries' figures reflect their positions after accession, but Turkey has just started the negotiations. Most probably, with the reinforcements of the structural reforms during the accession process, Turkey will be even better off in terms of productivity when the date of accession finally comes. In fact, in the last 4 years, as I mentioned before, the cumulative increase in labor productivity has been 35% in Turkey. And it is expected that in the upcoming period, increases in total factor productivity will be one of the most important contributors to our growth potential. As a consequence of the envisaged huge productivity increase, and according to the baseline scenario on the EU accession process, the Turkish State Planning Organization estimates that by the year 2015, the Turkish economy would grow by a total of 82% on a sustainable path, This implies an average growth rate of 6.2%. The other items in the decomposed income per capita equation are employment, dependency ratio, and participation rate, which are closely related to a country's demographic factors. Growth rates of population in the old and new members of the European Union are quite low, and the slowdown in population growth leads to aging in the European Union countries. This implies serious problems for the European Union economy in general and its labor market in particular. First of all, the problem of aging in the European Union suggests lower labor participation rates and higher dependency ratios in the future. This will certainly decelerate the potential growth rate of Europe. Then, fiscal problems due to increasing social security and healthcare costs as population ages come to the forefront. On the other hand, Turkey's demographic profile makes it different than both the old and the new members of the Union. Turkey is relatively a large country with a young and fast-growing population. The Turkish accession today would imply an increase of more than 70% in the European Union population. Indeed, between 1990 to 2003, the average population growth rate and the birth rate in Turkey have been 1.8% and 2.3% per annum, respectively. The Turkish population is expected to stay young in the foreseeable future, whereas in the years 2000 and afterwards, the EU-15 has 0.3% of population growth rate and 1.1% of birth rate on average at highly decreasing trends. According to certain estimations, in the year 2020, the average age in the EU-15 will be 43, while it will be only 33 in Turkey. This means that in the future, Europe will probably be experiencing labor shortages rather than the unemployment problems of today. What this argument implies that Turkey's young and expanding population will reduce the negative impact of the EU's aging and diminishing workforce in the coming 15 to 20 years. Turkey with a young population will be an important asset in the long term in competing with countries such as China, India, and the United States. As another variable in the equation, we observe an advantageous position for Turkey regarding the dependency ratio. As a result of a young and growing population, the dependency ratio of the Turkish population is in a decreasing trend. As of the year 2000, the share of the age group of 55 and above in total population is 29% and in the EU-15, while that of Turkey is a mere 11%. The International Labour Organization estimates that the said ratio will increase to 36% in the EU-15 by the year 2020. However, it is expected to be only 16% in Turkey by that time. According to another study by the United Nations this time, the European Union would need an average of 6.1 million immigrants a year from 2015 to 2040 to maintain a ratio of 3 working age adults for each retiring. This, I believe, clearly implies a substantial contribution of Turkey to the European Union on the demographic front. On the other hand, when it comes to labor force participation rate in the income per capita equation, Turkey definitely lags behind the European Union. One of the reasons of Turkey is lagging behind is the low female participation rate in the labor force. Although the female participation rate in banking, legal, and medical sectors are among the highest in Europe, the very low participation in rural areas caused the overall female participation rate to remain quite low. Another reason of low participation rates based on official figures is the high share of the unregistered economy. With the ongoing reform process and their expected effects on the structure of the labor market, the share of the unregistered economy would decrease and then the female participation rate would increase. This will imply further increase in the labor force participation rate in the Turkish labor market in the near future. Moving on to the employment side of the equation, I will mention some other important points regarding the Turkish labor market. First of all, although the unemployment rate in the Turkish economy is quite high compared to with the European Union members, we observe that the total increase in employment throughout the year 2004 was much higher than that of the EU members and acceding countries. Another notable issue about the structure of our labor market is that Turkey's economy is moving from a labor-intensive structure towards a capital-intensive one. And it is a natural consequence that during this period, some sectors are expanding while others are contracting. What this implies is that the structure of employment has also been changing. In fact, even though it is still high compared to the European Union members, the share of the agricultural sector in total employment has been falling, while that of services sector has been on the rise. And I believe that Turkey's young and dynamic demographic structure supports easier transfers between sectors and facilitates improvement in the sectoral dispersion of employment. Having mentioned all these demographic and labor market conditions of the European Union and Turkey, I need to emphasize the importance of making further progress on educational reforms in Turkey. It is clear that in order for the young population to be an advantage for us, a very well-designed and planned education strategy is a must. Indeed, the education level of the overall population in Turkey is getting better, and Turkey is in fact catching up with several of the new EU members. In the 25 to 34 age group, 11% of population has high level of education, which corresponds to the same level with Slovakia and nearly the same level with the Czech Republic. Hence, as the older generation leaves the market for the younger generation and the educational reforms are put into practice during the accession process, the education level of the Turkish labor force will increase and both the European Union and the Turkish economy will benefit from it. Ladies and gentlemen, having touched briefly on the advantages of the European Union from Turkey's membership, what I'd like to talk about next is the other side of the coin. That is the advantages of Turkey from the accession process and the ultimate membership. As I mentioned in the early part of my speech, the performance of the Turkish economy for the last 4 years clearly indicates that Turkey successfully continues the process of economic structuring. However, in our view, all the achievements so far now belong to the past. Nowadays, we have to start viewing developments with a longer term and broader perspective in the context of the adjustment process for the EU membership. I believe that the European Union negotiations process will establish the best conceivable framework not only for the continued reform process in Turkey, but also for the new reforms within the framework of convergence to the European Union. The membership will act as a much-needed reform anchor for Turkey. The membership process is expected to show its very first impact on increasing predictability, or in other words, decrease in uncertainty in policies and the economy. In a parallel manner, there are two more important benefits to the European Union membership process for Turkey. The first one is institutionalization of policies, and the second one is improvement in governance indicators in the country as a whole. Developments in these areas, together with increasing credibility, would carry the Turkish economy to a better macroeconomic equilibrium point to operate. In the area of trade, though tariffs on both sides were abolished with the completion of the customs union, the accession process and the membership would bring about the elimination of non-tariff, administrative and technical barriers, and so foreign trade relationship with the EU would further develop. This would clearly result in welfare gains not only for Turkey but also for the EU due to the trade creation effect. And according to a study of Kappel and his colleagues in March 2004, bilateral trade between Turkey and the European Union can increase by around one-third once Turkey has become a full member of the single European market. Moreover, thanks to the intensive reform agenda, the investment climate in the Turkish economy would improve for both domestic and foreign investors. In consequence, it is reasonable to assume that foreign direct investment would increase strongly. According to some studies, again, the EU membership is estimated to result in 2 to 4 billion euro worth of FDI flows per year. This in turn will not only contribute to the strengthening of the economy as a whole, but will also help to deal with current macroeconomic concerns such as the current account deficit. I have to add that the economic benefits of FDI are potentially high because FDI not only brings in long-term capital, but also technology, management skills, and opportunity to reach new export markets. In this framework, the membership would give both an opportunity and an obligation for local firms to improve their businesses at the micro level through increasing their productivity, enhancing their management and technical skills, together with the quality of labor force and switching the products with high value added. In short, as the Turkish economy moves along the membership process and converges to the European Union economy, we will see a high and satisfactory level of sustainable growth, advance further in economic stability, and therefore in the enhancement of the welfare of the society. Ladies and gentlemen, as you all know, we have started negotiations only a few weeks ago. It is obvious that the EU enlargement with Turkey will be very different from the previous enlargements in the sense that Turkey is not similar to the other countries in its dynamics, including economic, demographic, and political ones. However, a closer look at the enlargement periods of the new members reveals the fact that these periods are associated with both debates and concerns. But when we look at the results, we see a win-win situation for both the European Union and the new member states. And I believe that Turkey's membership will be another win-win situation as well. All in all, I believe that Turkey's membership will create a synergy in which both the European Union and Turkey could enjoy a mutually advantageous conjunction of their different characteristics. However, one has to remember that during the process, both Turkey and the EU have their own responsibilities. In this respect, each party should make every effort to fulfill its own homework. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor, for an excellent lecture covering many different aspects. Thank you for the clarity of the delivery, the information, the depth, most impressive, and we appreciated the lecture. There is time now for some questions. I imagine there will be a number of questions. I suggest we try to take them three at a time and then invite the Governor to respond accordingly. When you're making your questions, could you please just identify who you are? And do please try to remember that we're inviting questions rather than another speech or lecture. Okay? There's a lady here just behind you. There's a microphone, if you can wait for the microphone.
My name is Aylin Pektaş. I'm a Turkish citizen who resides in the UK at the moment. What's the latest situation in terms of distribution of income at the moment? Thank you.
Okay. Can we go to the gentleman to the left, please?
Some analysts in Turkey express concern.
So could you just identify yourself?
Yeah, my name is Tuncay Gürhan. I'm living in London. Express concern on so-called hot money in Turkish market, and which cannot be originate, and which is not controlled. So what the distinguished speaker would comment about it.
Okay. Do we have a question here?
Jonathan Liebenau from London School of Economics. Transparency International ranks Turkey rather low in its regard for corruption and transparent transactions. I'd like some comments from you about that in relation to the expectations for FDI, and also to comment on what the central bank can do to improve the quality of legal affairs and transparent transactions within Turkey.
Thank you.
Okay. Shall I? First of all, on the distribution of income question, I don't have the most recent measure of the Gini coefficient and the like in my hands here, but I can assure you about two points which are very important. Throughout the chronic inflation period, which lasted more than three decades, income distribution got worse and worse in Turkey. That's exactly what inflation does. Middle classes almost disappeared. And the second point related to that is the fact that ever since we got inflation down to single-digit levels, I can only say that at least we have stopped the deterioration in income distribution. Whether we are going to be able to improve it, will depend on how well we do as we reach sustainable growth rates in the economy and how good we perform with the structural reforms list. The second question was about hot money, which is always a hot issue in Turkey. I see that it's also a hot issue in London, to which my answer could be quite long. I'll try to make it as brief as possible. First of all, for years and years, at the central bank in Turkey, that is, we always said that when we talk about hot money in Turkey, it's in fact domestic hot money. Much more important than hot money that would come from abroad and then would go back at the sight of the slightest crisis or turbulence. Why? Because the Turkish economy in time has become quite dollarized, so much that in fact at one time more than 50% of the total deposits in the banking system was in foreign exchange and not in the national currency. That is now changing. We have a definite trend of reverse currency substitution in the economy. So in a way, the economy is finally de-dollarizing after all these achievements. But of course, there's a long way to go. But coming to that part of hot money, which you probably had in mind, because that's always the case when I get questions, hot money coming from abroad. So in other words, a part of the short-term capital inflows. Then again, we are not scared of it. We would be scared of it in 2001 and before, and for good reason, well, we already know it, because, again, at the sight of the slightest crisis or turbulence, not only in Turkey, but also somewhere else, in Argentina or in East Asia, short-term capital would flow out of the country, and we would at least have a turbulence in the Turkish economy, if not a crisis. But there was one important element there, which I always like discussing, which is the exchange rate regime at that time was either a fixed exchange rate or a kind of foreseeable exchange rate, a kind of pegged exchange rate system. We have tried a lot of varieties of those. Meaning that when capital was flowing out, the central bank felt the need to defend a certain level of exchange rate under such an exchange rate regime. And of course, the burden was on its reserves. And as reserves came down, at some stage, of course, people would have the feeling that, okay, the central bank cannot continue with the present level of the exchange rate. They are losing their reserves all the time. And there will be an even bigger run on foreign exchange. And finally, of course, we would call it a devaluation of the currency, which is a very simple scenario. And it happened in so many countries. But under the float, this is not possible. Under the float, the burden is not on reserves, but on the exchange rate. If capital is to go out, then the exchange rate will adjust. What does the central bank think about the sharp depreciation of the lira then? Well, we would only worry about it, according to our legal mandate, we would only worry about it to the extent it has an effect on inflation, a negative effect. And that, in turn, depends on the pass-through effect from exchange rate to inflation, which is now getting, by the way, weaker and weaker, again, thanks to float, you see. Other than that, we don't see why we would worry about it. We have seen a huge rise of the dollar against the euro in the past, and then the euro has gone up against the dollar, and now the dollar is going against the euro, and I think we have to admit this as a quite natural development. That's exactly what I think about what you call hot money. Just allow me, I know my answer has been quite long, but allow me to say that hot money, what you call hot money, went out of Turkey on at least 7 occasions, in fact, since we have floated the currency. I'm not talking about the previous occasions. And this was not a crisis, nothing. You see? Okay. The question about transparency and what can the central bank do about it, especially as it is related to FDI coming into the country and also the legal aspects. Of course, our role in that, I'm talking about FDI now, our role in that can only be an indirect one. We are a quite transparent central bank and also a quite a vocal one. And we keep talking about all kinds of issues, not necessarily in the area of the central bank, because we find all these areas to be very important for reaching a high and satisfactory level of sustainable growth in the Turkish economy. The FDI issues are obviously one of them. And I think in that the government made a lot of progress as they amended some laws and regulations. They show some efforts to improve the investment climate, such as establishing an investor relations office, and there are some other aspects. But of course, there are still a lot of things to do, no question about it. Certainly, the transparency in all areas of the economy would help it. The central bank so far, I think, has been a kind of leader in that area. Just to give an example, back in 1998, I suppose, we were probably one of the few central banks in the world to publish its balance sheet on its website on a daily basis. Today, we publish almost everything. It's not only the data, it's about policies, press releases, reports, and all that. So much that, in fact, we create, I believe, a lot of noise, but I like it. But anyway, that's all I can say about this. The government has to do a lot.
Thank you. Some more questions. Gentleman here.
Hello. Alice Kaynar. First, I want to send my greetings back from Turkey from my father, Murat Kaynar, and uncle, Sherif Kaynar.
You didn't have to say that. Yeah. Okay. Well, everybody. Yeah.
And my question is, do you have the desire to carry on your current position in central bank? Is it ending in 2006? Or do you think it's enough?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, two more questions.
Can we take a question here at the very front, please?
Hi, my name is Arzu, final year politics student at London Metropolitan University. My question is, will Turkey's accession to EU improve a negative impact on EU's unemployment rates with European companies relocating to Turkey?
I think it's very well. Maybe if you keep
I'll repeat it. Will Turkey's accession to EU improve a negative impact? Improve a negative impact on EU's unemployment rates with the European companies relocating to Turkey?
Okay. Time for one more. Over here, please.
I'm Zeynep Kılıçoğlu. I'm working in KPMG in London. Through your presentation, I was really very clear about the advantages of Turkey's membership to European Union. But I just want to step back and ask you if there are any disadvantages that we may cause to them, and what might be the possible arguments they might put forward if they ever decide to put a barrier through the accession talks.
Barrier to what, sorry?
To our membership in the economic sense.
Okay. So, first of all, about the term renewal and all these issues. I know of no central bank governor in the world who appoints himself to the post of governor. It's always some other body, as far as I know, and in our case, it's the government, you see. So I think the question should be rather addressed to the government. And the Prime Minister is around, if you can get hold of him. The second thing, when you are the governor of an independent central bank, you exercise all your powers very transparently. That's at least what I know about it. Okay, very transparently, very openly. You become a bad guy with everyone. That's the nature of the job, you see. And that's why, in fact, you are appointed for a fixed term. You see. Otherwise, they would fire you immediately, you know. But at the end of your term, then it's, again, somebody's authority and also responsibility, by the way, to whether they continue with the same governor or not, so it's up to them. On the relocation of firms in Turkey as the European Union accession process evolves and how it would contribute to employment, well, I think the answer is in the question itself. If we see more and more firms locating in Turkey, that would definitely contribute to employment. That's what I think about it. But of course, it's not the only thing. So that's why I make it very simple and I say whether it's the FDI or some other forms of capital investment or what we do in Turkey for a high and sustainable growth rate, whatever, the crucial element in all that is the long-run sustainable growth rate in Turkey. That's going to tell us something about how employment will evolve in the future and its implications for the European Union. About the disadvantages, so I told the audience about the advantages for Europe and for Turkey from the eventual membership of Turkey in the European. What are the disadvantages? Clearly, I cannot see one. Unless, of course, one of the parties is not able to evolve in the right direction, because we know that Turkey still has important problems. It has, as I said, a long list of structural reforms to accomplish.
But if it fails to deliver in that area, then of course some disadvantages obviously would appear in the future, as the economy would not be mature enough to join the European Union. But you will admit that the same thing also applies to the European Union itself, who has deep-rooted problems that require a lot of reforms. That's all I can say on this.
Thank you. Time for some more questions. Gentlemen here.
Hi, good evening. Gerard Bourgeois. I just wanted to ask a markets question. I mean, when you guys intervene in the markets, in the foreign exchange markets, mm-hmm. you always seem to do it at the same level and always 50-50 basket as well. I was wondering, I mean, kind of why you guys did that, and also is there a fear that it's becoming a bit too obvious for investors mm-hmm. and speculators?
Thank you.
Well, it's been... Oh, sorry. We have to continue. Okay.
Take a few
when it's foreign exchange, I cannot help it.
There's the gentleman at the back here.
My name is Ajit. I would like to ask you, after the negotiations for the entry are successful, is there a target time within which you hope to be a member of the single currency? And how would you work towards that target time, whatever that may be, to reduce Turkey's foreign currency debt?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Time for one more question at the back, just behind, please.
Hello, Adrian Basiri, second year student of geography with economics. You mentioned about privatization. To what extent do you think or agree that the military, with institutions such as OYAK, are an interference to equitable banking privatization?
First of all, I'm glad that you asked this question about foreign exchange interventions, because that will kind of enable me to kind of save you from some kind of illusion which can be very fatal in these markets. There's no such a level. Whatever coincidence that you might see at the intervention levels, that may be misleading for future interventions. We do have a lot of measurements for volatility. They are always alternative to each other. We don't use any single one of them, and we don't rely on any single one of them. And the message is very clear. If we see excessive volatility, we simply go into the market. Coming to the single currency, when Turkey will be a member of the monetary union, this is at least how I understood the question, and how the debt profile would evolve until that time, my feeling is that most probably, of course, the monetary union would follow the union, I mean, Turkey joining the European Union, and that's still a long way to go. And until that time, I'm pretty much sure that Turkey will show a lot of improvement in its debt-to-GNP ratio, as it is already showing it. So I don't have worries about the debt reduction until that time. As I said, my worry would be rather based on specific convergence areas. Growth is very important in telling us something about it. On privatization, I think that is rather a political question that I would not like to answer, you see. Being the head of the central bank, we always put some distance between politics and the central bank so that the politicians do not interfere in our activities. Sorry.
Some more questions. Lady here.
Zeynep Kutatkoblik, Deutsche Bank. Following up on the latest great news of the approval of IMF reviews as well as the Turk Telecom privatization, I would like to ask you about some vulnerabilities and risks in the near term, such as the current account deficit as well as pension deficit.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Gentleman here at the front.
Pretty much a follow-up question to the previous one. There's been a lot of new money coming in, foreign direct investment, as a result of these privatizations. What is the expected steady state foreign direct investment in the period leading up to the accession? Is there any studies on that, please?
The gentleman with the watch and the arm.
Hi, Dennis from Economics at LSE. A lot of your talk hinges on convergence, but what if, say, inflation or asset prices in Turkey diverge from the rest of Europe, what would Turkey do if it has joined the foreign the single currency, it's given up its monetary policy independence? What would Turkey do to deal with such problems?
That's up to the Union. Okay. First of all, on the risks in the Turkish economy, if you see one of those central bank presentations to the government or to the parliament that we have to do every 6 months, as we are an accountable central bank, you will always find a slide or one or two slides on risks. We always put them there. We think a relaxation of fiscal policy, a relaxation of the incomes policy, failure to deliver the structural reforms, and all these would, of course, constitute important risks for the future of disinflation and also for the future of growth in the economy, because we know that expectations have quite a fragile nature, given our very bad track record, and that's why we should be very much careful about all these. Do we see the current account deterioration as one of the risks? Well, as I answered the question on hot money, and I don't have much to add to that, under the floating exchange regime, and since the government continues unabated with a very tight fiscal policy, and since the central bank also continues with a very tight monetary policy, I wouldn't consider that as a big risk. As I said, if such tight policies are not enough to stabilize the current account deterioration, then it is very simple, very simple. The exchange rate will do the job. On the what is the normal FDI amount that we should expect on an annual basis in the coming years, I think, but there are some studies, I don't recall the figures, and I think on the other hand, it is still too early to say that. The more progress that we make within the accession process, and the higher are the chances of attracting FDI from Europe. It has already started to come. In fact, it started to come in 2004. It's going on an increasing basis in 2005, but I wouldn't know about the figures, really. And as far as I understand from the third question, we are now in the monetary union. That's, I don't know, 12 years or 16 years, whatever, later. And then we see an increasing inflation in that part of the European Union, which is Turkey, and also increasing asset prices. And how should the central bank react to that? Well, my answer, as far as I can see from your question, it will be quite simple. I hope I don't miss anything. Frankfurt does the job. And you are part of the decision-making process in Frankfurt. That's about inflation. Okay? That's all I know. The second thing about asset prices. Not much to add to the present discussion on about how the central bank should deal with asset markets, bubbles, and all these. Most probably, I think this is more or less the current thinking and the widespread thinking, you should talk about it, and that's all. I don't think interest rates should be used against it anyway. I hope I don't miss anything in your questions. But if so, you're going to ask me after the session. Okay.
Okay, let's take a question from upstairs. No microphone there, so please just shout at us. Lady at the front, please.
Muradoğlu from Kas Business School. How long do you think it will take Turkey to have full membership in the union and to have membership in the monetary union? And in your opinion, which one is the most difficult in terms of legislative and structural change during this process?
So the question is how long that will take, you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the gentleman here.
Maurice Goudenos, LSE, Management Sciences. My question, I have two questions, in fact. The first one is, why is Turkey opposing the idea of a privileged partnership? It's a more political one. And the other one, you were speaking of the European aging problems. Don't you think that it's exactly the strongly growing Turkish population that is regarded as a problem in the Turkish membership?
Okay.
First of all, about whether the inflation figures and growth figures do reflect the reality or not, or they are virtual or accurate. Okay. Well, that kind of question, if you allow me to say that, I always find it interesting. You know why? When we had a growth rate of -9.5% back in 2001 and an inflation rate of 73%, nobody ever asked me whether these figures were virtual. It's the same kind of measurements that the State Institute of Statistics has with growth, and now we have high growth rates. We have approached almost 10% last year, and some people think it is virtual. But the same also applies to the inflation. Of course, we now have a new basket, but you would normally expect that it measures inflation better compared with the old basket. That's why we keep changing it anyway. No, I think all these statements about whether all these figures virtual are coming from those economic agents in the country who have not been able to adapt themselves to the changing environment. That is very clear. I have a very clear conviction on that. I keep traveling all over the country, thanks to our communications policy that we are improving all the time. And that's exactly the impression that I'm getting from not only that kind of questions, but similar questions. Not everybody is doing well, I can tell you. You have 10% growth last year. No, not every sector is growing. So that's why. On the second, well, that was, I think, again, the new inflation basket does better reflect the actual consumption patterns in the Turkish society. But, of course, it can always be improved. How long would the Turkish membership take to join the European Union? As I said during my speech, it's rather a political process. The ultimate decisions, just like the decision on October the 3rd, will be political ones. And that is difficult to say. But since nobody talks of a period shorter than 10 years, we can easily say that it's at least 10 years, and some people are talking about 15 years, but that's all I can say. Then which one would be more important, if I got you well? Is it the political union, I mean the membership, or is it the monetary union? Well, all of them have their own challenges, you see. Monetary union looks like a kind of technical matter, but in fact it goes beyond it, and it can be a very delicate issue to fulfill all these Maastricht criteria, various Maastricht criteria. That can be a very delicate issue. But of course we're going to work on it, and then I won't see any problem by that time as we become a member. From a legislative point, as you said, of course it's rather on the government side, all these structural reforms. To be able to complete all these chapters, the government has to come up and the parliament have to come up with a lot of reforms. And some of them are quite painful ones. We even have today some painful drafts. So, it will be a painful process, no question about it. That's what I can say. On the privileged partnership, I really don't know what this implies for the Turkey's future in the European Union, because I believe, as far as I can understand, we already have a privileged partnership. Our association agreement with the Union goes back to 1963. And we have a customs union. I don't think the European Union does customs union with every country in the world, so we already have it. And so many times in many summits and other conferences, whatever, it has been decided that the ultimate goal is not privileged partnership at all. Can you repeat the last part of your questions? Because it was too quick, so I wasn't able to take notes. It was about population, but...
Yeah. It's not more, I mean, from the European side,
Okay. Well, again, there are two scenarios. Suppose that the present growth rates, what is the birth rate or the population growth rate, the overall growth rate, whatever, for some reason get higher than compared with today, then of course that would decrease the chances, especially if we are not able to provide a very high level of sustainable growth rate to the economy, you see. But suppose that it's the other way around, you see. We are able to grow at a very high rate, say close to 10%, okay, and then at the same time, contrary to the projections today, the population growth rates are much lower. I tell you my personal feeling about it. It's purely personal, okay? It may so happen that in 10 or 15 years' time, there's a referendum in Turkey about accession to the European Union, and the public says no. Everybody has always talked about referendums in Europe, and we have seen some referendums. We may see some referendums in the future. Nobody talks about referendums in Turkey. I find it very surprising, because we have that institution in our constitution. That's all.
Thank you. Are we okay for a few more questions?
Well, I'm okay. I can continue if you like.
Thank you.
If you're not bored, I'm not bored.
Clearly we're not. Clearly we're not. The gentleman at the front, please.
Okay. Nick Carver from Central Banking Journal. I understand that the Turkish Central Bank is going to start targeting inflation properly next year. Could you say who will decide on the framework? Will it be a target or a range or a point? And what is your preference as governor?
Okay. Please, can you repeat the first part of your question? I didn't get it, sorry.
Next year, the central bank will start targeting inflation properly. Who decides on the range or point that you're going to target, and what is your preference?
Thanks. More questions? Okay, are you going to shout at us as well, please? One more question? I thought someone was waving at me. Sorry, here, yes.
Thank you. In the year 2000, before the central bank decided to fluctuate the currency, there was only a few hours' notice, I think. Was it possible to take further precaution and give further warning to people? Because as far as I remember, because I was still in the UK at the time, it was only the previous evening that was announced that the government was going to stop controlling the currency. Okay. So I was just wondering if there was any possibility of giving any further warnings. Okay. Thank you.
Can you announce the lottery in advance?
Yeah. Well, you already got the answer, but... okay. About full-fledged inflation targeting that we're going to adopt by January 2006, I can tell you that it's been a gradual process. We called our monetary policy implicit inflation targeting, in fact, since early 2002, because there was nowhere else to go. But because the conditions were simply not there, we didn't call it full-fledged inflation targeting, but we have adopted a gradual process towards this. We still discuss and work on the modalities of full-fledged inflation targeting at the central bank. So it's still too early to comment on point targets or range targets, and there are a number of other modalities as well. Obviously, as you certainly know from your courses, if you have worked in that area and all that, all of them have their own pluses and minuses. And one has to be very careful, because there's always the risk of making the expectations worse, you see. So it's too early to comment on that. On how monetary union, after the monetary union, and since the responsibility for monetary policy goes to Frankfurt, so some of your sovereignty goes away from the country, How that would affect growth, I think that will definitely depend on the overall growth in the European Union, and that in turn would depend on the structural reform process in the Union and also in Turkey, since it will become part of the Union. That's all I can say on that. You sacrifice one piece of your sovereignty, if I may say that, but because you see advantages from the Union. About sorry, what was the last question? I cannot read my own.
Announcing the floating.
Ah, okay, that was about the float. Well, I know of no case in recent years, I don't know what happened in history, of announcing to the public in advance that, well, you are under a fixed or pegged exchange rate system, but you're going to float by that time. Immediately you would feel the floating itself, because there will be either a revaluation of the currency or devaluation inevitably, you see. So that's why. So you take a decision during the night and then you announce it in the morning, and that's how you do it. The problem back in 2001 was that, according to some reports, because it has been widely studied by everybody in Turkey, including the judicial circles and all that, is that the decision had been delayed by the government. Because at that time it was the government's authority. The government who decided on the exchange rate regime. Now it's both the government and the central bank. It is now much more clear in the legal framework. Okay.
Okay, I think the governor's schedule means we should now draw matters to a close. Before closing, on your behalf, I'd like to thank the governor for his presentation and for his answers. Thank you for your questions. I personally found the presentation and the answers to the questions extremely interesting and clear. So we thank the governor on your behalf. Thank you for the presentation and thank you for your visit.
Thank you. I hope it's been useful.